Chapter 3. The lamp casts a circle of light upon the table. Before me is a pile of blue exercise books, and alongside a bottle of red ink. I look through the notebooks, mark the mistakes, lay the blotting papers inside, and clap them to. I stand up. Is this life, then? This dreary uniformity of days and lessons? But how empty it leaves all the background. There is still left much too much time to think. I hoped the routine would quiet me, but it only makes me more restless. How long the evenings are here. I go across to the barn. The cows snuff and stamp in the gloom. Beside them on low stools squat the milkmaids, each in a little room to herself, the walls formed by the black and white bodies of the animals. Small lanterns are flickering over them in the warm air of the stall. The milk spurts in thin streams into the bucket, and the breasts of the girls joggle beneath their blue cotton blouses. They lift their heads and smile and breathe and show sound white teeth. Their eyes shine in the darkness, and there is a smell of cattle and hay. I stand a while at the door, then go back to my room. The blue notebooks still lie under the lamp. Will they always lie so? And I, shall I always sit there, till little by little I grow old and at last die? I decide to go to bed. The red moon climbs slowly up over the roof of the barn and casts an image of the window on the floor, a diamond and a cross within it, that become gradually more and more askew the higher the moon rises. In an hour it has crept onto my bed, and the shadowed cross is moving over my breast. I lie in the big peasant bed, with its cover of red and blue squares, and cannot sleep. Sometimes my eyes close, and I sink down, whizzing through space without bounds. But at the last moment a sudden, bounding fear jolts me back into wakefulness, and again I am listening to the church clock as it strikes the hours. I listen and wait and toss to and fro. At last I get up and dress again. I climb through the window, lift out the dog, and go off to the moor. The moon is shining. The wind blows gently, and the plain stretches away. The railway embankment cuts darkly across it. I sit down under a juniper bush. After a time, I see the chain of signal lamps light up along the track. The night train is coming. The rails begin to rumble softly, metallic. The headlight of one locomotive leaps up over the skyline, driving a billow of light before it toward me. The train roars past with bright windows. For one moment, scarce a breath, the compartments with their trunks and their fates are right close to me. They sweep onward. The rails gleam again with wet light, and out of the distance now stares only the red rear lamp of the train, like a glowing evil eye. I watch the moon turn clear, then yellow. I walk through the blue twilight of the birch woods. Raindrops spill down from the branches onto my neck. I stumble over roots and on stones, and when I return, the leaden dawn has come. The lamp is still burning. Desperately, I glance round the room. No, I cannot stick this. I should need to be 20 years older to be so resigned. Weary and spent, I begin to undress. It is too much trouble. As I go off to sleep, my hands are still pressed together. I will not give up. I will not give up yet. Then again, I sink down through space without bounds. And cautiously worm my way out. Slowly, one inch and then another. The sun is burning on the golden slopes. The broom is in flower, the air hot and still. Observation balloons and white wind clouds hang on the horizon. The red petals of a poppy flower rock to and fro before my steel helmet. A very faint, hardly audible scratching comes across to me from beyond the brambles ahead. It is silent again. I wait on. A beetle with greenish-gold wings crawls up a chamomile stalk in front of me. His feelers are groping over the jagged leaves. Again, a light rustling in the noonday silence. The rim of a helmet shows over the bushes. A forehead, clear eyes, a firm mouth. Searchingly, the eyes move over the landscape and return again to a pad of white paper and some crayons. Quite unsuspecting of danger, the man is making a pastel of the farm yonder and the dark copper beeches in the quivering air. I drag the hand grenade toward me. It takes a long time. At last it is lying beside me. With my left hand, I pull the button and count under my breath, then send the bomb flying in a low curve to the blackberry bushes and slip back swiftly into my hollow. I press my body close down on the earth, bury my face in the grass, and open my mouth. The crash of the explosion tears the air, splinters twanging. A cry goes up, long drawn, frantic with horror. I hold the second bomb in my hand and peer out from my cover. The Englishman is lying clear in the open field. His two legs are blown off at the knees. The blood is pouring out. The bands of his puttees, far unrolled, trail out behind him like loose ribbons. He is lying on his belly. With his arms, he paddles the grass. His mouth is wide open, shrieking. He heaves himself around and sees me. Then he props himself on his arms and rears his trunk like a seal. He shrieks at me and bleeds, bleeds. The red face grows pale and sinks in. The gaze snaps, and eyes and mouth are at last no more than black caverns in a swiftly decaying countenance that slowly inclines to the earth, sags and sinks into the dandelions. Finished. I worm myself off and begin to work my way back to our trenches, but I look around once more. The dead man has suddenly come to life again. He straightens up as if he meant to run after me. I pull the string of the second hand grenade and hurl it toward him. It falls a yard short, rolls, and lies still. I count. Count? Why doesn't it explode? The dead man is standing upright. He is showing his teeth. I throw the next hand grenade. It misses fire also. He has made a few steps already. He is running on his stumps, grinning, his arms stretched out toward me. I hurl my last hand grenade. It goes flying to his chest. He wards it off. I jump up to run, but my knees refuse to work. They are soft as butter. Endlessly, painfully, I drag them forward. I stick fast to the ground. I wrench, I hurl myself forward. Already I hear the panting of my pursuer. I drag my failing legs with my hands. But from behind, two hands close around my neck. They bear me backwards to the ground. The dead man is kneeling on my chest. He hauls in the putties trailing out behind him over the grass. He twists them around my neck. I bend my head away. I brace all my muscles. I fling myself to the right to escape the noose. Ah! A jerk, a strangling pain in the throat. The dead man is dragging me toward the precipitous edge of the chalk pit. He is rolling me down into it. I lose balance, struggle to catch hold. I am slipping. I fall, cry out, fall endlessly, cry, hit something, cry. Darkness comes away in great clots under my clutching hands. With a crash, something falls down beside me. I strike upon stones, on sharp corners, iron. I shriek uncontrollably, swift, wild yelling I cannot stop. Shoutings, clutching at my arms. I beat them off. Somebody trips over me. I snatch a rifle, grope for cover. I wrench the weapon to my shoulder, pull the trigger, still yelling. Then, suddenly, like a knife, it pierces the uproar.
Birkholz!
Again.
Birkholz!
I jump up. That's help coming. I must cut my way through. I wrench free. I run. I blow on my knee and I fall into a soft hollow, into light, shrill, stabbing light.
Birkholz! Birkholz!
Now nothing but my own cry like a spear in space. Suddenly it breaks. The farmer and his wife are there before me. I am lying half on the bed and half on the floor. The farmer beside me is picking himself up. I am desperately clutching a walking stick in my hand, as if it were a rifle. I must be bleeding somewhere. Then I see it is only the dog licking my hand.
Teacher, says the farmer's wife, trembling. Teacher, whatever is the matter?
I understand nothing.
How have I come here? I ask in a gruff voice.
But, teacher, wake up. You've been dreaming.
Dreaming, I say. You think I could have dreamed that?
Suddenly, I burst out laughing. Laughing. So shrill it racks me. Shrieks of laughter that pain me. Laughter. Then the laughter in me suddenly dies.
It was the English captain, I whisper. The one.
The farmer is busily rubbing his bruised arm.
You were dreaming, teacher, and fell out of bed, he is saying. You wouldn't listen to anything, and you nearly murdered me.
I do not understand him. I am utterly spent and forlorn. Then I see the stick in my hand. I put it away and sit down on the bed. The dog pushes in between my knees. But I do not lie down again. I wrap myself in a blanket and sit at the table. The light I leave burning. And so I sit a long while, motionless and with absent gaze, as only soldiers can sit when they are alone. After a time, I begin to be disturbed and have a feeling as if someone else were in the room. Slowly, how slowly, without effort, I feel sight and perception returning to my eyes. I raise my eyelids a trifle and see that I am sitting directly opposite the mirror that hangs over the little washstand. From its slightly wavy surface, there looks out at me a face with dark shadows and black eye hollows. My face. I get up and take down the mirror and put it away in a corner, glass to the wall. Morning comes. I go to my class. There sit the little ones with folded arms. In their eyes is still all the shy astonishment of the childish years. They look up at me so trustingly, so believingly, and suddenly I get a spasm over the heart. Here I stand before you, one of the hundreds of thousands of bankrupt men in whom the war destroyed every belief and almost every strength. Here I stand before you and see how much more alive, how much more rooted in life you are than I. Here I stand and must now be your teacher and guide. What should I teach you? Should I tell you that in 20 years you will be dried up and crippled, maimed in your freest impulses, all pressed mercilessly into the self-same mold? Should I tell you that all learning, all culture, all science is nothing but hideous mockery, so long as mankind makes war in the name of God and humanity with gas, iron, explosive, and fire? What should I teach you then, you little creatures who alone have remained unspotted by the terrible years? What am I able to teach you then? Should I tell you how to pull the string of a hand grenade? How best to throw it at a human being? Should I show you how to stab a man with a bayonet? How to fell him with a club? How to slaughter him with a spade? Should I demonstrate how best to aim a rifle at such an incomprehensible miracle as a breathing breast, a living heart? Should I explain to you what tetanus is, what a broken spine is, and what a shattered skull? Should I describe to you how brains look when they scatter about, what crushed bones are like, and intestines when they pour out? Should I mimic how a man with a stomach wound will groan, how one with a lung wound gurgles, and one with a head wound whistles? More I do not know. More I have not learned. Should I take you to the brown and green map there, move my finger across it, and tell you that here love was murdered? Should I explain to you that the books you hold in your hands are but nets with which men design to snare your simple souls, to entangle you in the undergrowth of fine phrases and in the barbed wire of falsified ideas? I stand here before you, a polluted, a guilty man, and can only implore you ever to remain as you are, never to suffer the bright light of your childhood to be misused as a blow flame of hate. About your brows still blows the breath of innocence. How then should I presume to teach you? Behind me still pursuing are the bloody years. How then can I venture among you? Must I not first become a man again myself? I feel a cramp begin to spread through me, as if I were turning to stone, as if I were crumbling away. I lower myself slowly into the chair and realize that I cannot stay here any longer. I try to take hold of something, but cannot. Then, after a time that has seemed to me endless, the catalepsy relaxes. I stand up. Children, I say with difficulty. You may go now. There will be no school today. The little ones look at me to make sure I am not joking. I nod once again. Yes, that is right. Go and play today. The whole day. Go and play in the wood, or with your dogs and your cats. You need not come back till tomorrow. With a clatter, they toss their pencil boxes into their satchels, and twittering and breathless, they scurry off. I pack up my things and go over to the neighboring village to take leave of Vili. He is leaning out of the window in his shirt sleeves, practicing the song, "In the merry month of May, all things are renewed," on the fiddle. A huge supper is spread out on the table. "My third today," he says gaily. "You know, I find I can eat like a camel from pure foresight." I tell him that I mean to quit this evening. Vili is not a man to ask questions. "Well, Ernst," he says thoughtfully, "it certainly is slow here, I admit. But so long as they keep feeding me like this," he points to the table, "not 10 horses will drag me out of this Pestalozzi horse box." Thereupon, he hauls out from under the sofa a large case of bottled beer. "High frequency," he beams, and holds the label up to the lamp. I look at him a long while. "Ah, Vili, I wish I were like you." "I can believe it," he grins, and a cork pops. As I go to the station, a couple of little girls with smeary mouths and flying hair ribbons come running out from the neighboring house. They have just been burying a dead mole in the garden, so they tell me, and have said a prayer for him. Then they curtsy and shake hands with me.
"Goodbye, hair teacher,"